A New Campus. When Jobs was 13, he had looked up Bill Hewlett in the phone book, called him to score a part he needed for a frequency counter he was trying to build, and ended up getting a summer job at the instruments division of Hewlett-Packard. That same year, HP bought some land in Cupertino to expand its calculator division. Wozniak went to work there, and it was on this site that he designed the Apple I and Apple II during his moonlighting hours. When HP decided in 2010 to abandon its Cupertino campus, which was just about a mile east of Apple's One Infinite Loop headquarters, Jobs quietly arranged to buy it and the adjoining property. He admired the way that Hewlett and Packard had built a lasting company, and he prided himself on having done the same at Apple. Now he wanted a showcase headquarters, something that no West Coast technology company had. He eventually accumulated 150 acres, much of which had been apricot orchards when he was a boy, and threw himself into what would become a legacy project that combined his passion for design with his passion for creating an enduring company. "I want to leave a signature campus that expresses the values of the company for generations," he said. He hired what he considered to be the best architectural firm in the world, that of Sir Norman Foster, which had done smartly engineered buildings, such as the restored Reichstag in Berlin and 30 Simmeriaks in London. Not surprisingly, Jobs got so involved in the planning, both the vision and the details, that it became almost impossible to settle on a final design. This was to be his lasting edifice, and he wanted to get it right. Foster's firm assigned 50 architects to the team, and every 3 weeks throughout 2010, they showed Jobs revised models and options. Over and over, he would come up with new concepts, sometimes entirely new shapes, and make them restart and provide more alternatives. "When he first showed me the models and plans in his living room, the building was shaped like a huge winding racetrack made of three joined semicircles around a large central courtyard. The walls were floor-to-ceiling glass, and the interior had rows of office pods that allowed the sunlight to stream down the aisles. It permits serendipitous and fluid meeting spaces," he said, "and everybody gets to participate in the sunlight." The next time he showed me the plans, a month later, we were in Apple's large conference room across from his office, where a model of the proposed building covered the table. He had made a major change. The pods would all be set back from the windows so that long corridors would be bathed in sun. These would also serve as the common spaces. There was a debate with some of the architects who wanted to allow the windows to be opened. Jobs had never liked the idea of people being able to open things. "That would just allow people to screw things up," he declared. On that, as on other details, he prevailed. When he got home that evening, Jobs showed off the drawings at dinner, and Reed joked that the aerial view reminded him of male genitalia. His father dismissed the comment as reflecting the mindset of a teenager. But the next day he mentioned the comment to the architects. "Unfortunately, once I've told you that, you're never going to be able to erase that image from your mind," he said. By the next time I visited, the shape had been changed to a simple circle. The new design meant there would not be a straight piece of glass in the building. All would be curved and seamlessly joined. Jobs had long been fascinated with glass, and his experience demanding huge custom panes for Apple's retail stores made him confident that it would be possible to make massive, curved pieces in quantity. The planned center courtyard was 800 feet across, more than three typical city blocks, or almost the length of three football fields, and he showed it to me with overlays indicating how it could surround St. Peter's Square in Rome. One of his lingering memories was of the orchards that had once dominated the area, so he hired a senior arborist from Stanford and decreed that 80% of the property would be landscaped in a natural manner with 6,000 trees. I asked him to make sure to include a new set of apricot orchards, Jobs recalled. You used to see them everywhere, even on the corners, and they're part of the legacy of this valley. By June 2011, the plans for the four-story, 3-million-square-foot building, which would hold more than 12,000 employees, were ready to unveil. He decided to do so in a quiet and unpublicized appearance before the Cupertino City Council on the day after he had announced iCloud at the Worldwide Developers Conference. Even though he had little energy, he had a full schedule that day. Ron Johnson, who had developed Apple's stores and run them for more than a decade, had decided to accept an offer to be the CEO of JCPenney, and he came by Jobs' house in the morning to discuss his departure. Then Jobs and I went into Palo Alto to a small yogurt and oatmeal cafe called Fresh, where he talked animatedly about possible future Apple products. Later that day, he was driven to Santa Clara for the quarterly meeting that Apple had with top Intel executives, where they discussed the possibility of using Intel chips in future mobile devices. That night, U2 was playing at the Oakland Coliseum, and Jobs had considered going. Instead, he decided to use that evening to show his plans to the Cupertino Council. Arriving without an entourage or any fanfare, and looking relaxed in the same black sweater he had worn for his developers' conference speech, he stood on a podium with clicker in hand and spent 20 minutes showing slides of the design to council members. When a rendering of the sleek, futuristic, perfectly circular building appeared on the screen, he paused and smiled. "It's like a spaceship has landed," he said. A few moments later, he added, "I think we have a shot at building the best office building in the world." The following Friday, Jobs sent an email to a colleague from the distant past, Ann Bowers, the widow of Intel's co-founder, Bob Noyce. She had been Apple's human resources director and den mother in the early 1980s, in charge of reprimanding Jobs after his tantrums and tending to the wounds of his co-workers. Jobs asked if she would come see him the next day. Bowers happened to be in New York, but she came by his house that Sunday when she returned. By then, he was sick again, in pain and without much energy, but he was eager to show her the renderings of the new headquarters. "You should be proud of Apple," he said. "You should be proud of what we built." Then he looked at her and asked, intently, a question that almost floored her. "Tell me, what was I like when I was young?" Bowers tried to give him an honest answer. "You were very impetuous and very difficult," she replied, "but your vision was compelling. You told us, the journey is the reward. That turned out to be true." "Yes," Jobs answered. "I did learn some things along the way." Then a few minutes later, he repeated it as if to reassure Bowers and himself. "I did learn some things. I really did."